You've been listening.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's news from the Drug War Front. My name is Jeff. My co-presenter is Marion. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, listeners. And welcome to what a day.
We're delighted to have a special guest, Rebecca Davey. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Rebecca from
Good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome, listeners, to News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, which is Canberra's peer-based drug use organisation. The aim of the show is to inform and hopefully educate listeners about the failure of the war on drugs, or to describe it more accurately, the war on people who use drugs, and obviously we'll also promote the services offered and provided by CARMA and also other agencies in the AOD sector in the Australian Capital Territory. Now, the contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast does not necessarily reflect the views and or policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. CARMA does not condone nor condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. CARMA recognises that drug use happens, and as such, CARMA focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. CARMA seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use, as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use, through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred healthcare, and equity of health service delivery for all people. So that's what we're about. Will we go to a song and then we'll come back and have a chat to...
Yeah, we'll have our visitor, hey?
Chat with our visitor.
What a good
Rebecca.
Idea.
I've picked an Australian band, the Hilltop Hoods, their classic, The Hard Road.
I needed a guide like a blind veteran's dog, cause I was going nowhere like a child's letters to God. The life's road was hard, I was never so lost that I looked for an answer and I met as a boss. I never did pop pills or cocktails, just rock tills. Kids with skills still got a rasp for cops still. They'd have me in the back of a paddy down the locker, smack me, pat me down for a bag. Mom's a rocker and bail me out. I fell you out once again next weekend, bail me out drunk again, and I never will forgive myself for putting you through all that hell. I went from high school dropout to factory labourer, slave to the clock until four. Went from sleeping on the floor to being out on tour. Now there's nothing me. I finished with the bang like a Cobain's biography.
Going down the hard road.
Down the hard road.
Only change that I wanted was enough to buy a drink. Was on a path to nowhere, the harder the road. The more broken baggage we carry, the larger the load. The school dropback, I'm knocked out, chased by the cops out. Got clout, dumped by my girlfriend and locked out. Been broken, beaten, even choked to beating. A dope MC, even never lost hope and dreaming. We used to thrash, push the car, silver engine and fail. If I never had bail, maybe I'll be dead or in jail. Well, man, I got no one else to blame. I'll thank my family and music for keeping me sane. But that's the place where I started working late nights, never seeing daylight, getting paid like a slave might. And I've done too many years to miss this for my missus, to have to tell my son he nearly never existed.
Going down the hard road.
Down the hard road. And I speak what I feel in the booth, in the spirit of truth. Cause all these kids that I meet, man, they mirror my youth. And I could have gone the wrong way,
the easy option,
but I chose to go the long way.
Streets are watching,
so keep a lookout, look out. Be ballers, keep your hook up. Pull a page, rip my book out, and pull out your finger, put your foot out. And keep a lookout for what we put out, the brand new flavor for your cookout.
Going down the hard road.
Down the hard road.
Don't know where I've been, but I think I feel a walking out.
right, the mighty Hilltop Hoods and the Hard Road. Okay, it's coming up about 24 minutes to 11. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front. And it's my very great privilege to welcome our special guest, Rebecca. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning. How are you all?
Good, and great to have you come in. For listeners who aren't aware of the organisation you work for, Arthritis and Pain Support ACT, can you tell us a little bit about
it? Yeah, so we support people with any type of pain. So often people come to us because they've got arthritis, because we, you know, wave the banner for arthritis. But really, we take on, we will support anybody with any sort of pain from any sort of origin. So we don't mind how long they've had pain or
Rebecca, is there another pain organisation as well, a pain support place?
So Pain Support ACT, we're a standalone, and we've
just merged in the last couple of years.
Because
I did have earlier in the year, I think, or maybe late last year, some of the stuff that was coming out of the pain support agency sounded quite difficult as an advocacy group to be saying that stuff for people with pain, to be saying, yeah, walk up Mount Ainslie or meditate, don't worry about your drugs. And tell me a little bit about you as a what you've become now.
It is really hard, Marion. And as you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know too, I also have a history in working in the AOD sector, and I still have very strong connections in the sector. So it is really, really hard. And I'm also a person that lives with chronic pain and have so for my whole life.
So it's almost a peer representation.
It is. And what is really hard is, and I often joke now, after years and years of working in AOD, I probably spend more time counselling people who are dealing with drug use and alcohol use, because a lot of people use alcohol to mask their pain. That's what I do the majority of now. And it is that really difficult stuff of, we are expected to push that line of don't take drugs. And look, I know personally, if I'm eating well, if I'm exercising, if I can keep my weight down, that my pain is better and I don't need as many drugs. But the reality is,
it's all that though, isn't it?
It is. Yep. And the reality is, we all live life.
Yep.
It's what we know with pain is, it's often the stuff in your head. It's the stress. It's the anxiety.
And that's scientifically proven.
Absolutely.
33% of the effect of any drugs, and I assume the effect of any pain, is what you think is going to happen.
Exactly. Yep? It's the fear of pain, or it's the body's learnt response as well.
Yep.
So you might not actually have, and we know this particularly with chronic pain, is that there's no tissue damage occurring anymore, but the body or the brain and the nervous system
remembers it all, like sympathetic pain. Yep.
And it's often easier to just go and pop a pill and get over it or get on with it,
because
than
then
it is
you
to
can
do
assume
else.
That you will be better.
Absolutely.
A third of you says it will.
And you know it's worked in the past.
Yes.
And that's the other thing,
absolutely,
is that we know it's worked in the past. So we have that really difficult line of, we do try and support government policy, just like, you know, Karma does, and all our AOD agencies in the ACT and across Australia definitely try and support government policy. But we also know when government policy is wrong. And it doesn't work for our clients. And that's what it comes down to. It comes down to the individual.
Isn't it? Doesn't it?
So it's really difficult.
Yeah, look, I've always argued on the show, Rebecca, that to me, avoiding or dealing with chronic pain is a fundamental human right. You know, there's no virtue in suffering.
Absolutely. That's right. Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting. I got an email from somebody who's probably listening today just last night, saying that the international, I can't remember the whole acronym, but the International Pain Specialist Group have actually just changed the definition of pain. And it's about, it's really lies around that it's the perceived feeling to the individual.
Yes.
And whilst that actual definition didn't change a whole lot, I think there was only a word or two, and I'm not the best wordsmith in the world. I tend to just go, oh, yeah, whatever.
I know. I love words. There you go. That's where I live. But I was brought up with a lawyer.
That's where you learn to value law.
Yes.
But what I noticed was point six of that definition was that health providers must always believe the person. And I think for the majority of our clients and the majority of people out in that broader AOD sector too that use the sector, because I know when I was working in the sector, there was a lot of psychological distress. We knew that a lot of the clients came with a lot of baggage from their childhoods in particular.
And what does baggage mean?
Open someone's
bag and you get everything comes out, doesn't it?
So we'd see that group of people, and then we'd see the people that had some sort of injury and had never been treated properly, and for years and years and years they had been prescribed drugs on and off, and then they were accused of being, you know, drug seekers and junkies and all those other dreadful terms that would get thrown at them, but they never actually got the root cause of their pain sorted out. No. So, and I would even see them. I have worked around TCs across Australia and New Zealand.
Communities, people.
Who
are not used to it.
And I would often see clients in there that would be struggling with their back pain still and whatnot because that has never been treated. Yep. Mm-hmm. Now, we know there's lots and lots of ways to treat that pain in a non-pharmaceutical way. But we need to acknowledge that pain, and we need to provide the treatment, and we need to provide them the support to go on that journey. And another term I'm not particularly fond of, but it is a bit of a journey. But it starts with respecting that they have an experience of pain.
That's really important.
And no person is ever going to get through this hump in their life if they're not respected for where they are.
One thing that bothers me with the way this situation has been heading, Rebecca, is the tendency to undermine the role and the respect for the doctor and patient relationship. You know what I mean? Like, especially if you've had a doctor for quite some time and they know your medical history, surely that doctor is the best place to be able to decide what medication for pain is appropriate, and to have a health department bureaucrat or something write a letter saying no, this looks a bit too much is really undervaluing the doctor's role.
Absolutely. And the other thing we're finding, and I know I'm certainly finding as an individual, and I'm just one of you know, tens of thousands across just this region, that if I go into the doctor and even ask for something as mild as Panadeine now, it's like, I don't know. Yes, it's a prescription drug.
And they have to ring up, and it's a Schedule 8 drug because it has a codeine. Codeine content of what, 0.9%?
That's right. Yeah, 9 milligrams.
Nine milligrams.
Now, look, I also know as a health professional myself and a person working in the area that I work in that codeine is really no good for chronic pain, that there's much better drugs for chronic pain.
Yeah.
But it's not always chronic. If I've spent a day out in the garden or a day running around after kids or been, you know, been on street stalls as my jobbing, requires. Then I am really sore, and it's actually acute pain for that day and that I need that drug to get to sleep. Mm. So, you know, and if I don't get to sleep, then the pain accelerates because that's, you know, it's all that stuff around. If you can't sleep, then you don't eat well, and then you fall back into that
cycle. And you're not healing as quickly.
Well,
and your pain is not acknowledged. No one distinguishes between one kind of pain and another.
And another. That's right.
And it's like when people don't have a toe. But they've got a pain in their toe.
Exactly. Yeah?
So what's called phantom pain, or used to be called phantom pain, it's still up there in your head.
It's because you still have a nerve system that remembers having a toe. So.
Rebecca, can you tell me perhaps what the gender balance is between your clients? Do you find that men tend to not grizzle, or do you find they tend to grizzle more? Nothing biased about me.
From a woman. So, look, like most health
or
services...
Or do they grizzle differently, maybe?
They do it differently.
Yeah.
Men tend to leave things much, much longer, yes. so they tend to find themselves in more trouble. And it's, I think, for me, it's been interesting being back in a health service as opposed to the drug and alcohol sector,
yeah.
where you saw
which
actually
is a therapeutic
men,
service, yeah.
especially the therapeutic
that
services.
Was what we were trying to get at for the last few weeks. We've had a women's specific programs with women's stories that women are the last to come to treatment.
Absolutely.
In drug and alcohol,
yes, yes.
But men are the last to come to treatment in terms
in
of
health,
yes.
Yes, yeah. And look, and we know in drug and alcohol that women are the last to come for services because often they involve so much time and women are caregivers.
Well,
and
they
else,
run
and
the risk of losing
suit.
Their children too,
that's
remember.
Right, exactly. So they don't want
to fraught themselves. With difficulty.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's really difficult for women to get that support. But it's interesting, I see a lot more women probably in my service now
who are
struggling with these issues, but good. We're seen as
I
being
I showed
safe.
You my finger when you were
you
here.
Did. You did. So Marianne has lovely
I know that, a great lump of arthritis in that finger.
Yes, yes. So I guess in some ways at least arthritis ACT and pain support ACT can be a safe place for someone to come and maybe start
that
journey.
Oh, so you have a shop front?
Yes, yes. We have offices or shop fronts in Bruce,
right.
and in at Shout in Pierce.
Okay.
So people
right.
can drop in at any time.
So largely the south side. Oh no, Bruce is north side.
Bruce
Melconnon.
Is north side.
Yeah, of course.
Yep, yep. So split,
where do you
split
live, Marianne?
Between the two?
Melbourne.
So, Rebecca, what other sort of issues? Actually, can I ask you just if you can explain a little bit more? I fortunately never suffered from arthritis, but I've spoken to people that have, and for some of them, it is incredibly debilitating.
Yes,
can you give
yes.
our listeners just a sense of...
Yeah. So, well, musculoskeletal pain and really arthritis, because that's the main thing that causes it, is now the leading cause of disability in Australia. So, and it costs the most of any health condition in
yes,
Australia.
That would make sense.
So we see a huge wave of people, you know, slather of people from across the community. There's also about 120 different types of arthritis.
Wow.
So just raising his eyebrows, he can't believe it.
Is that because that's how many joints there are in the body?
No,
or is that
it's because of the various types of autoimmune disease. So most autoimmune diseases are an arthritic type of autoimmune disease. And there's some similarities in some, and then there's some that are really widely spread. And it can affect anything from your skin. So psoriatic arthritis,
yes,
often it's your skin that you see a lot of disfigurement.
Psoriasis being
skin disease. Yeah, yeah. So, but it actually, you know, it actually manifests itself as an arthritis eventually.
And that's like shingles pain too?
So shingles
different?
Is quite different. So shingles is
okay.
from the virus attacking
Sorry
the
if
nerves.
I'm interrupting.
No, Jeff. That's fine.
No, I'm just, Jeffrey's question I wanted you to get to with the answer.
Yeah. So it can... the majority of people we see actually have the autoimmune form of arthritis because there's not a lot you can do. So osteoarthritis, which a lot of people think of as the wear and tear arthritis. Now, that's not really what it is, but it's the stuff where you see your hips and your knees in particular degenerate. But that can be repaired by a replacement or quite good physio and the like. But it doesn't really affect your life too much more beyond that if you can get good treatment as you go. When it's autoimmune disease, it affects every aspect of your life. It's your immune system. So it's every aspect of your life. So people get very tired. They get very depressed and anxious. They
sounds very COVID-like.
It's
doesn't
very
it?
COVID-like, yes.
Wow.
And in fact, one of our concerns with COVID is that I also, for my sins, chair the Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Society.
Yeah.
And
did you got nothing else to do?
I have nothing else to do. That's right. That's right.
No, I understand that.
I had
role.
Bread enough, so I decided
Once you
to
get
do
into
this.
Something, it becomes
you
so
don't
pervasive.
Get out.
Yeah. You just just get more and more involved.
Exactly.
Because everything touches everything else, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And look, I also believe that I've got a set of skills that my workplaces have instilled in me, and I should be able to share.
You have learned
with the rest of
Give
the community.
Some credit.
So one of the things we're finding with COVID now is that it is leaving people with this awful post-viral malaise, yes, which is very like MECFS. I think for people that have struggled in that world, and I know there's listeners to your show that belong to that world, I'm actually wondering if the world is going to change for them now, and that they may be believed a lot more, because there's going to be this whole new population of people with the same sort of symptoms and struggling in the same way.
Let's hope that can be a positive.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we don't want people to get COVID, that helps those that are living with MECFS, then maybe there is a tiny little bit of a silver lining.
I might have to talk to you offline, because many years ago I actually got chronic fatigue syndrome myself, and I wouldn't have wished it on my worst enemy, honestly.
No, it is the most horrendous condition, and I think the most horrendous part of it is that people aren't believed, and it can take so many years to get a diagnosis, and even then people aren't believed.
Interviews with people in the United States, Rebecca, people are saying that they're post disease phase, if you like, or they don't know when the disease is over, because they continue to feel lethargic and, you know, like they can't move, they can't think, they can't do anything. They don't know if they've stopped being COVID, COVID and started having something else.
Exactly.
So it is still,
you
know, they've moved into perhaps a different phase of the illness, but they don't know that because you can't see a doctor.
That's right.
It's so hard to see a doctor.
Absolutely.
You can talk to one on the phone.
And we see people like Jeff who has, you know, he's probably largely recovered from MECFS.
Yeah.
And then we see people who never recover, and there's no time frame. There's no timeline. There's no rules or reason to it. And that's the most distressing part of it.
Yeah, that would be demoralising.
It is. Yeah.
Is that largely post-viral?
It's largely
infection?
Post-viral
Okay,
infection.
As opposed to bacterial?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, that's intriguing.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So what sort of areas, if you had often asked this question of people from organisations, if you had the opportunity to speak to government and say this is the number one priority issue, I'd really recommend you take some action on, what would
it would be? About expanding pain support services. It's, you know, it doesn't matter, and it needs to be across the board, supporting those that need to have the pharmaceuticals, supporting those that the conservative management.
Welcome home, Rebecca.
Exercise.
You're in the right place, aren't you?
I am in the right place. You know, supporting people at every step of the journey. There's not enough places, particularly in Canberra. It's horrendous.
Indeed.
We know at the pain clinic at TCH, whilst they do a good job for some people,
when they get there,
a lot of people won't go there because they feel like they're being treated as drug seekers as well.
Yes.
We have a lot of people that won't go there because of the urine testing and whatnot that then ends up on their health records, so they won't use the program. It's really difficult, and it's not respecting the person's perception of pain.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I had my need for the drugs that I was being prescribed evaluated by a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist wrote in my referral letter, or back to my doctor, that I had a mild addiction. Now,
what does that mean?
That's what I say. Words are so damaging,
they
can be so sympathetic, but they can also be so detrimental. So my doctor was then obliged to deal with prescription of the drugs that I was on as if I was an addict.
Hmm.
right?
Exactly.
And to these particular range of drugs, which are now Schedule 8 drugs.
That's right. But you know what? The thing is that we do know, and from my nursing background as well, that if somebody is on these sorts of drugs for more than about 6 weeks, they will develop an addiction. Mm. That's because that's the way the drug works.
It's the way your head works too, doesn't it?
The head works. It's the way our nervous system works.
Yes.
Now that, we're learning so much more about the pain, brain barrier and the nervous system and whatnot, you would hope that we could move away from that, you know, that line of thinking. I really think it's going to take a generation of medical expertise and learning to move.
We've been waiting Jeffrey and I've been working for 40 years in this area.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
On radio for the last 10, Jeffrey,
Yep, pretty much.
Arguing against or for this whole.
That's right.
The labelling, the use of words.
Yes.
We do have now, we've got recently, there have been more. There's been more assistance with people saying don't use these words, pejorative. I've been looking for that word for the last half an hour.
There you go.
Pejorative words, because they are so damning.
That's
if you drug user or drug addict.
Yes.
That's a pejorative term.
It is,
so
absolutely.
And you cannot say without any bias, because the words themselves have an inherent bias.
That's right.
So if you don't change the language, you don't change the language, you don't get a sympathetic response.
That's right. And I think that's where I probably have a little bit of an advantage working now out of Arthritis ACT rather than working out of Directions where I had worked in the past, is that I can actually just talk to the individual. They're not here, they're not coming to see me because of, in inverted commas, an addiction.
A problem.
It's
not problematic,
That's right. Yeah. They're actually coming to talk to me about themselves.
Yes.
And that's actually how we
like
to do it. Oh, I love it. I feel like I'm at home in treatment. Absolutely.
You come to a place where you're allowed to accept
people
for who and what they are.
Absolutely.
And
look at the whole person, you know, like I think, and we have this problem everywhere, don't we, in the health system, is that people get siloed.
The ill system, isn't it, really?
It's an illness system, and people are siloed. So when you go into drug and alcohol treatment, you're there about your drug and alcohol. But as I was saying earlier, when I used to hang around a lot of therapeutic communities and I'd hear people talking about their back pain, I couldn't do anything about their back pain.
Yeah.
Whereas now I go, well, actually, I can do both, and that's great. That makes me feel good. I just hope it makes the people that come in under our care.
Look, the holistic approach is the right way to go, Rebecca.
It's the only way to go.
If you don't have a range of things available, you're not going to be able to touch people where their own biases lie too.
Absolutely.
So you have to get through their own to not be seen as a drug seeker.
That's right.
But they're also, it's quite, I remember when we first set up the detox service, right? CDC it used to be called in the old days when it first set up. We weren't funded for anything but one staff member.
That's right.
But we did have a lot of volunteers, like a naturopath and an acupuncturist and a massage therapist.
Yes.
And we tried to use, where we could, natural therapies.
Yes.
Because we couldn't afford doctors and nurses, so we couldn't prescribe drugs. But what we did do was discover the use of some of the natural therapies was really cleverly done if you could apply them at the right time.
Absolutely.
But didn't want to just rely on that, because I thought the government actually had a responsibility to deal with drug dependence, addiction, and the associated problems like legal issues that go with it.
And I think you'll also find the other thing that people that came in and used those services at the time would have found was the naturopath and the massage therapist and so forth had time.
They gave
the individuals time. Whereas often in services like that, you see a doctor for, you know, well, we talk about 5-minute medicine and that's what it is.
And now it's phone 5-minute medicine, which is even less.
So you don't actually have time to unravel discover what's really going on, and you feel pushed. I've got to go in there. If I go in with my shopping list, they raise the ring, what's really at the root of the problem, and no one ever goes in to and says the first time, this is really what the root of my problem is.
You have to test your doctor, don't you?
You do.
You have to find somebody to get on with.
And someone you can rely on.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Any last words you'd like to add? Rebecca, we'll put all the information about your service up on our Facebook page and the Karma page.
This has been really intriguing, honestly.
Oh, no, that's fabulous. Look, I just want to say that if anyone is struggling with chronic pain, to give us a call anytime. If you just look us up on the website, so it's www.arthritisact.org.au. You'll
going out
find
with Rebecca
us.
Now.
And we're really happy to take the time to listen.
Do you want to give out the phone number?
Yes, so the local number is 6251 2055. So that's 6251 2055.
Well, look, I just want to say how much we appreciate you coming in, and delighted that there is somebody of your expertise, experience, caliber,
And yes, lovely to have your attitude.
Yeah,
yeah. It's nice to speak to somebody who actually understands where we are and is not afraid to say so. Lovely to see you. Love to see you again, Rebecca.
Anytime, anytime.
Yep. All right, we'll go to a song. This is Creekside, and this is Why We Do. All right, that was Mudvayne and World So Cold. Hope you enjoyed that one, Dave. I just want to do a little shout out to one of our much-loved volunteers, Joseph. He's not feeling too well, a bit sick in the tummy this morning, so get well better soon, my friend.
Yeah, good night, Joseph. Look after yourself. And I'd like to do a shout-out to David, Karma David, my friend in the morning, David. I did say I'd say hello to you, but I bet you're not listening.
All right. We'll press on with the show. I wanted to highlight or just mention to listeners that a very important webinar coming up soon. It's entitled Dual Pandemics. What will COVID-19 mean for hepatitis C elimination? I think that's quite an interesting topic. The event
relevant.
Is going to be held on today week, which is Tuesday, July the 28th from 1 till 2:30. It's free. And the blurb is, Australia is the world leader in its efforts to eliminate hepatitis C and to improve the health of people who use drugs. But COVID-19, on a backdrop of economic uncertainty, anxiety and unemployment, has the potential to disrupt our support, prevention and cure efforts, especially given the populations most impacted by hepatitis C and drug dependence are some of our most vulnerable Australians. How is COVID-19 creating new environments and challenges? How do we adapt the delivery of services and policy to maximise people's health and continue to drive down hepatitis C in Australia? How do we best mobilise communities in our responses? Facilitated by health reporter Dr. Norman Swan, this event will bring together affected communities, doctors, scientists, health and community workers, researchers and the public to discuss the immense challenges that COVID-19 brings to the whole issue of hepatitis C elimination and the health of people who use drugs, and to discuss strategies to ensure that Australia stays on track to become one of the first countries in the world to eliminate hepatitis C. I'll just mention some of the speakers quickly, Marion. Jude Byrne, National Project Coordinator from AVIL, the Australian Injecting Illicit Drug Users League, is speaking. Also, Sione Crawford, who is the Chief Executive Officer of...
Oh, Sione,
Our sister organisation, Harm Reduction Victoria. Greg Dorr, one of the senior experts in hepatitis C treatment. He's the head of Viral Hepatitis Clinical Research Program at the Kirby Institute.
We've got the lights back on. We can read again.
Technical work at 2XX on the lights. We were sort of reading in
very
the balloon.
Very exciting, yes.
All of a sudden, it's like we're in the disco and the light.
Scrutinising the page, looking for words.
Too bright. Carrie Fowley, Chief Executive Officer, Hepatitis Australia. Jules Kim, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Scarlet Alliance.
Oh, good.
Another great speaker.
So you've got a really, really diverse panel and informed, diverse, informed and... representative panel, so all organisations or peers that are represented by those groups will be there talking. That's great.
Well, I've signed
on the webinar, I beg your pardon,
and it's free.
So please get in touch with that. If you do, the webinar will be held on World Hepatitis Day and is a collaboration between AVIL, Hepatitis Australia, APSAD and University of New South Wales, Sydney. Sydney's premier research institutes, the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre and the Kirby Institute. So that sounds important, people. Just get onto it if you can. If you need more information about it, get in touch with Karma, or it'll be on the website, I would imagine, that information.
It will be, yes.
And it's really important. If you remember when Chris first came, the Karma's CEO first came on, he talked about the protocols that ACT Health and together with Karma had developed to manage people with dependence problems, particularly opioid dependence, and allied with COVID as well. So, and that includes people with hepatitis C.
Absolutely.
So we have to look at, and as Rebecca was saying, post-viral problems and the connection between hepatitis C and COVID-19.
I think a lot of people
really
are going to
I think some of those questions would really pertain to what's going on and what are we going to do with the population, keep them alive well. And even in the absence of, well, health, at least not so bad ill. Yes? Okay. So what have we got? The next thing I thought, Jeffrey, we'd have a look at, we have a song first? Another song? Or do you want to do another article?
Yeah, do a quick story. Yeah.
Okay, there's one short one here called Distress and Pain, which I think is pretty appropriate. Key reasons for prescription opioid abuse. Sick, I'll just put that in commas. This is from miragenews.com, July the 9th. Okay, a study led by Monash University researchers in collaboration with Turning Point and Ambulance Victoria has shown that July the 9th, okay, a couple of weeks ago, that distress and pain are key reasons people are taking opioids in higher doses than prescribed or without a prescription, referred to as extra medical prescription use. Using data collected during ambulance attendances between 2013 and 2018, the study analysed paramedic records relating to the overuse of oxycodone, which is seen in most overdose cases and is the most commonly prescribed opioid used to treat pain, as well as tapentadol, a newer opioid which has been associated with lower levels of misuse or harms. The study, led by Associate Professor Suzanne Nielsen, found strong similarities in both drug types, but surprisingly highlights that people self-medicate due to a complex mix of mental health issues, chronic illness, work-related stress, or family problems, I suspect that should say. Previous studies have largely focused on extra-medical prescription opioids in groups with substance use issues. This study examined all people who required an ambulance following extra-medical pharmaceutical opioid use and found that found they were most commonly in the 35 to 54 age group, and more harms were among women, that's 55% of all ambulance attendances in the study. There were five main factors that contributed to people's overuse. One, psychological distress, that was 28%. Physical pain, 19%. Social stressors, that's 13%. And unintentional non-adherence, that's 9%. Opioid use disorder was 7% of attendances, with over one-fifth of the cases having two or more contributing factors.
I think that speaks back to what Rebecca was saying about
being
a holistic and focusing on the individual.
The needs, I agree. So, quote, we expected to see differences in the context that these two opioids were used, but we found that despite a presentations relating to oxycodone, the actual contexts of use were surprisingly similar. Associate Professor Nielsen said, I'd be interested to note, Jeffrey, before you go on to your bit in this, what the breakdown, more harms were among women, 55% of all ambulance attendances. Okay, whether men were less likely to call the ambulance, whether that was a question that they asked.
No. Indeed. The findings of the study show that to reduce harms with prescription opioids, we need interventions that address the multiple and complex needs of people with chronic pain and also mental health conditions, rather than focusing only on people who use these drugs in a recreational context. Quote, the common narrative is that harms come from people using these drugs to, quote, get high, or that harms occur among people with drug use problems. This study challenges those findings. Mm. The most common contexts of use were for relief of mental health symptoms or to relieve pain, often chronic pain, said Associate Professor Nielsen. In most situations, these people are not intentionally trying to end their life, but they may be looking to escape from trauma or extreme distress, end quote. Mm-hmm. Over the past two decades, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of deaths worldwide from prescription opioid use, with opioid-related deaths almost doubling in Australia in the decade from 2007. And the findings of the study have been published in the Drug and Alcohol Review. Yes. But I think it's important to point out that the scale of the problem in Australia is minuscule.
Absolutely.
Compared to North America.
Compared with the United States, which is the subject of another article that we'll be possibly doing if we get to. But nonetheless, it's an interesting study and the interesting outcomes, I think, don't you?
And the range of reasons why people feel the need to self-medicate.
And it's often one or more reasons for using it. They've got breakdown to five reasons that they came up with, but there was not just one reason, it was a couple of reasons. It also, I think, highlights the naltrexone, the need for naltrexone availability.
Naloxone,
sorry. Oh, why do I keep on doing that? Sorry, Jeffrey. Sorry, Dave. But it highlights the need for that to be available and how much impact that's actually had on ambulance attendances, and particularly on whether men or women are using the naloxone, because I'd really like to know that kind of stuff.
Well, we could always get Dave to come on the show and talk about the breakdown of statistics.
He's got some stats on it,
hasn't
he? Yeah, it might be a good idea after he's done. What has he been doing it now? 2 years? Several years.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear a bit more about that. And I think what I would like is for our listeners to know how much impact the naloxone has had on our community and how useful it is, because I really want to emphasise to them that it's a really useful drug. It does nothing else but reverse opioid overdose, and it's available and it's free if you do the training.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
Yep.
Okay, we'll go to a quick song. Another Australian artist, Stevie Wright, from his solo career. Hard Road. I was going to play Evie, but it's a bit long, so we'll listen to Hard Road. Stevie Wright and Hard Road. Okay, it's 28 minutes to midday. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front on Community
People
Radio.
On People Powered Radio, 98.3 FM.
And
I have it on my T-shirt.
You have it on your T-shirt, and you have also the name of our show.
And the name of our show, which I did all my own self. But the 2XX T-shirt is available from 2XX Studios. So.
And if you like listening to our show or any of the other original shows, think of becoming a subscriber to 2XX.
A subscriber, and if you want to get involved with 2XX, even more so.
Even better,
Yep. Okay, so let's go to an international story. Just to highlight what's going on, taking back what's ours, an oracle of the movement of people who use drugs. This is a film of 10 chapters, and this is has been done by INPUD, which is the International Network of Drugs. And it's an oral history of the movement of people who use drugs. And episode one, it starts, okay, view the full series published each Monday throughout HIV 2020 online. There, that's HTTPS, www.HIV, that's the address.
I'll put it on the website.
I won't dribble it out at you. It goes on to say the global movement of people who use drugs has achieved exponential growth over the last four decades. Throughout the world, drug user-led advocacy has become a global phenomenon, pushing to protect and defend the health and human rights of drug-using community and other people facing marginalisation in society. In collaboration with the Rights Reporter Foundation, that's Drug Reporter, we are very excited to share Taking Back What's Ours, a new documentary film series which captures the history and genesis of the global movement of people who use drugs. This is really exciting, people, because the International Network of People Who Use Drugs have been putting out a lot of written stuff which has been highly intellectual, have been targeting at the international health organisations. But this is targeted at us.
Yes.
And to highlight peer organisations and what they are doing about reducing the harms associated with our community and in each country. So
and the long history and hard struggle.
Well, it's been going for such a long time, and the network's been going for such a long time. But in Australia, it's been going since, what, originally 1979, I think, Jeffrey. That's how old I am. Anyway, to go on. So it's a documentary film series which captures the history. And in this series, you'll meet activists undertaking critical work in their communities and learn how they navigate this work within the context of criminalisation, stigmatisation and oppression. The series is part of HIV 2020 Online, running from July through to October 2020. Starting on Monday the 6th of July 2020, we'll be releasing one episode per week. The film has a total of 10 chapters and will cover countries in all regions of the world. You can join the conversation over social media by sharing the film each week with the hashtags of Taking Back What's Ours, or let's hashtag Reclaim the Response, and hashtag HIV2020. Special thanks to Input board member Tony Van Montfort for driving this project and all the other outstanding activists featured in the series who are fighting for the rights of people who use drugs all over the world.
Look,
you're
seen,
in this, Jeffrey, aren't you?
The Australia episode will include me amongst a number of contributors. I've only watched the first episode so far, Marion, which covers Holland, Belgium and France.
Yep.
But we do get to meet Theo Van Damme.
I remember Theo Van Damme, actually. He's been around for quite some time.
Well, I've heard him referred to as like the godfather of harm reduction in Holland.
Absolutely, yep.
He's tells some very funny stories.
I bet he does.
One in particular, he says that when the junkie union was sort of first getting up and running, he said they asked politicians to come and meet with them and they politely declined. So he said, well, maybe we could come to you. And he said Dutch politicians have to sort of be polite. So they said, okay, you come to us. And they organised a meeting, and then it got to a point where a few of the drug users said, oh, can we have a smoke break? And, oh, yeah, sure, you can have a smoke break. And evidently a few people pulled out their foil and started chasing the dragon. And the politician said to Theo later, don't ever do that to me again. That's not what I meant by a smoke break.
Well, obviously they hadn't been listening to what he meant by peer organisation yet. So they weren't listening. Jeffrey serves them right. You need to listen to the language.
Absolutely.
Peer organisation is really important. So episode one is the Netherlands, Belgium and France. And it's in this first episode of the series we meet Theo Van Damme, who we were just talking about, one of the central founding figures in the Netherlands drug user movement. We explore both the growth of the movement in the Netherlands and how it transpired similar movements in how it inspired similar movements in Belgium and France. Episode two is Canada. In the second episode, we explore the history of the movement in Canada, starting in the early 1990s with the formation of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. And if you've been listening to the show over the last few weeks, you would have heard the amount of stuff that they've been doing over Canada and what they've been demanding.
Yeah, it's been
Winnipeg
great.
In particular has been really quite incredible compared with what we managed to demand over here. They've been demanding things like the give us cocaine, give us heroin, give us
safe supply,
absolutely, yeah. Which is very sensible. In response to the HIV crisis in particular, the work of VANDU, the Toronto Drug Users Union, the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and other drug user activist groups have contributed significant changes in how people who use drugs are treated and access harm reduction services in Canada. And then the one after that is the Australian one, isn't it, Jeffrey?
I'm not sure the order of release. I'm not sure. There's 10 of them.
I've got a sneaking suspicion that we were talking about it before, and the third one was Australia, I think.
Your guess is as good as mine, Mary.
No, your guess is better than mine because you were in it.
We'll wait and see. But
okay.
It's a high-quality production.
Yes, it's sounds great. Anyone pleased to see Input doing something visual that everyone can access? Because although I've read their products and I'm really impressed by that, this is accessible by everyone.
Yes. Well, video is something that everyone can put on their computer and watch.
Yeah. And an oral history is such a potent way of producing people's stories, people's lived experience, and that's important, particularly when we're talking about our peers. Speaking of which, okay, Dave, you are listening. I know you're listening. I got your message.
Awesome.
I just say this project was made possible by financial support of Bridging the Caps program. This unique program addresses the common challenges faced by sex workers, people who use drugs, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in terms of human rights violation and accessing much needed HIV and health services. Go to the HIVgaps.org for more information.
And if you want to find or access the first two episodes of this 10-part series, just type in INPUD, I-N-P-U-D, into your search engine, and you'll find the
links.
That
in capital letters, Jeffrey?
It'll probably work lowercase as well, but yeah.
Okay.
I-N-P-U-D. We'll go to a quick song, and then we'll wrap up this week's show.
Let's do that. The White Stripes. We up to that already. We are too.
Seven Nation Army,
almost
the White Stripes.
Almost by my time.
Yep. Oh, that's a cracking song, Marion. Yep. White Stripes and Seven Nation Army. We're into the last 15 minutes of this week's news from the drug war front, and just want to thank again Rebecca coming in and speaking with us earlier.
Oh, it was excellent. And I just repeat her, that phone number, 625-120-5534. Yes, that's 810 numbers. If you want to get in touch with the Arthritis and Pain Support Foundation.
Yeah.
As a really good peer organisation along the same lines, I guess, as Karma, only a collaboration of the two, but addresses many of the same issues, but from a different perspective.
Absolutely. Look, we haven't got all sufficient time to
read this whole article,
but it's from the New York Times, July the 15th. In the shadow of a pandemic, United States drug overdose deaths resurged to new record.
And long-time listeners will remember we've actually been talking about this for some time, and then it fell off the board with COVID-19 a little bit, but believe you us, it hasn't finished.
Hasn't disappeared.
No, at all.
All right, look, I'll kick it off. Drug deaths in America, which fell for the first time in 25 years in 2018, rose to record numbers in 2019, and it's continuing to climb. A resurgence that is being complicated and perhaps worsened by the coronavirus pandemic.
Despite what President Trump says.
I'll take anything he says with a grain of salt, I think, Marion.
Well, just don't take it full stop, I'm thinking.
Nearly 72,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year.
Well,
that's a lot,
Jeffrey,
of people.
That's just as nearly as many as before they had the naloxone.
According to preliminary data released last Wednesday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, an increase of 5% from 2018.
Yep.
Deaths from drug overdoses remain higher than the peak yearly death tolls ever recorded for car accidents, guns, or HIV/AIDS.
Why?
And their acceleration in recent years has pushed down overall life expectancy in the United States. It looks as if 2020 will be even worse. Drug deaths have risen an average of 13% so far this year over last year, according to mortality data from local and state governments collected by the New York Times, covering 40% of the US population. If this trend continues for the rest of the year, it will be the sharpest increase in annual drug deaths since 2016, when a class of synthetic opioids known as fentanyls first made significant inroads into the country's illicit drug supply. The 2018 decline was largely explained by reductions in deaths from prescription opioid medication, the drugs that started the nation's addiction epidemic back in the 1990s. But those declines appear to have been overrun by continued increases in deaths from illicit drugs, particularly methamphetamine, cocaine and fentanyl.
Can I do one paragraph of the next one? Because I actually mentioned what I was talking about a minute ago. President Trump made much of the slight decrease in overdose deaths, which is pretty much what President Trump does, takes statistics and uses them for his own use. The slight decrease in overdose deaths in 2018, pointing to his administration's efforts to expand addiction treatment and restrict the drug supply. Mr. Trump and Congress have provided several billion dollars in grants to states since 2017 for treatment, prevention and recovery services, expanding access to buprenorphine treatment in particular. But at the same time, the administration has continued fighting in court to overturn the Affordable Care Act, a law that has allowed states to expand Medicaid and provide free addiction treatment to low-income adults. I won't go any further than that. The rest of the article will be on the website. along with another couple of articles, because that's quite an extensive article. And that's from by Josh Katz, Abby Goodenough and Margot Sansa Katz of the New York Times, July the 15th. But it's really interesting if you want to have a look at the opioid deaths and a reason why we keep pushing this naloxone, the opioid recognition and response program that Dave does, and the very short, the brief intervention program that's being run with COVID.
I noticed it mentions that most of the heroin in the Western United States is in a form known as black tar, which is not familiar to users here.
That's old.
Sticky substance that is less easily combined with powdered adulterants like fentanyl, which is interesting.
Indeed. That sounds like opium, Jeffrey, straight from the poppy. I wonder if it's coming over the border like that.
It's from Mexico. Black tar heroin's been
because they're growing it there now, aren't they?
A long-term feature, especially on the West Coast. But the same, according to the Drug Enforcement Administration, increasing numbers of counterfeit pills containing fentanyl, often falsely marketed as oxycodone or other opioid painkillers, are appearing in states on the West Coast, which has contributed to
the
recent...
And we go back to that same thing again. We don't know what we're buying because we can't see the quality, quantity, purity and the price. We have no control. That's atrocious.
That was the whole concept of safe supply that the Canadian activists are coming up to.
Yep.
I've got time to mention a bit more. It says the isolation of quarantine comes with practical dangers as well. Using drugs alone is much more dangerous than doing so with others, since there is no one around if a revival attempt is needed. As we've said often with naloxone, you need somebody present to administer naloxone.
Yep.
And with in-person treatment vastly curtailed, including visits with doctors or nurses, frequent group counselling sessions and stays at residential treatment centres, there is far less of the emotional support that can be vital to people seeking treatment. Way too many residential programs just shut their doors and left patients with absolutely no safety net, said Percy Menzies, the president of the Assisted Recovery Centres of America, an outpatient treatment centre based in St. Louis. Another possible factor is that drug users have not been able to maintain their normal consumption habits during the COVID pandemic, either because they've lost their lost income, can no longer afford to buy drugs as often.
I had wondered that,
or because their local supply has been disrupted.
Yes.
Less use leads to lower tolerance, putting people at much higher risk of overdosing when they do get access to drugs. If there's no way to make money, your use goes down, your tolerance goes down, said Dr. Josiah Rich, a professor of medicine and epidemiology at Brown University. But if the economy opens a bit and you get some resources, maybe a stimulus check, you might try to use the amount that you used to and you don't have the tolerance to handle it. I think that's a really important aspect of...
It is, and that's something that was always a feature of the training with Jeff for the naloxone program, is that when people are most at risk is when they return to using, when they from a period of abstinence, when they get a new drug or a new form of the drug that they don't recognise, they're not used to. So keep that in mind, people. You can always use more, but you can never use less. So if you see people or you understand that there is a new source of supply, because the US is not much different from Australia, except that supply range is different. We have a different level of supply, different amount, and we need to be looking after each other. The use of naloxone is more incorporated into our everyday lives in Australia than it is in the United States, but we have a fewer number of users. Doesn't mean we have fewer people to care about, though. It just means that pro rata, we need to work a little bit harder. Although I'm pretty confident that Australia is doing fairly well, and certainly the ACT is approaching this subject, which is really important, of keeping us alive until we go out naturally.
Exactly. And it's a good moment to just mention that Karma is still open, Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. till 4. Staff and volunteers are there every weekday. Come into Karma. It's located in the Church's Centre, which is Level 1, 54 Benjamin Way in Belconnen.
And or contact them over the phone.
Or ring us over the phone.
6253 3643.
That's right. And you can also check us on social media, the Karma website, the Karma Facebook page, News from the Drug War Front Facebook page.
We have a podcast of this show every afternoon.
Podcast of this show
on
Podbean.
But you can talk to us over the phone too if you're worried about the virus, because there may be a resurgence. Be sure that we'll be here every Tuesday.
Yep.
Don't worry about that. But contact Karma by phone. If we do close down the shop front again, we'll still be available to you and the staff will still be available. The projects will all be available to you, whatever happens.
Absolutely.
So don't go running scared just because you hear that maybe the shop front's shut down. We'll be here every Tuesday, or somebody will be, to make sure that you have connections with Karma and with their workers.
Well, it's pretty much a week-to-week proposition, I think, with COVID, like with the spike in Melbourne and now Sydney. And
now it's gone back to Sydney and Batemans Bay. We just had 2 weeks of school holidays. Down, and Camp Garrans will have been down around the Bay Area, you can bet, during the school holidays, because that's where they go.
Mm-hmm.
Just what happens, that's Canberra's beach, is the Bay Area, from there down to Eden even. So, yes,
I think the
careful,
key thing
people.
Is just to try and stay as safe as possible.
That's right, and if you've got masks, wear them.
Yes, I wear a mask on
always,
buses.
Yeah, just look, assume, always been the case, the same with HIV and hepatitis. Assume that everybody has got it and nobody's got it. So you behave as if you are infected and as if you are not infected. Protect yourself and protect your friends and the people you come into contact with. It's really, I know it sounds like a complicated strategy, or that I'm oversimplifying it. But if you behave as if you are infected, you won't infect anybody else. If you behave as if you aren't infected, you won't get the infection from anybody else. So take on a mask, offer masks around to people, have them at home if you've got people you don't know coming, even if you've got people you do know coming.
It's a sensible precaution,
absolutely,
Marion.
What
it's not
hurt?
Too much to ask. And
no.
You might be protecting older relatives or older people in our
or
community.
Or just yourself.
Or just
Jeffrey,
yourself.
I'm
yeah.
old. Yeah, yeah, I'm happy to be protected.
Look, with my compromised immune system, I certainly don't want to be getting COVID either, and I'm sure you're the
I
same.
I don't think people want to get COVID. I don't think anybody wants to get COVID, but there are some nasty viruses going around, Jeffrey, that aren't COVID. But are, you know, like not just viruses, but also bacteria, things that may look like COVID, but actually present as tonsillitis.
Even just the normal
pneumonia.
Flu.
Pneumonia can look very much like COVID.
Yep.
So I think we've got to be very careful. Yes. Okay, let's go.
Thank you very much, Marion. We're done for another week.
Thank you, darling. Good to see you again, and we'll see everybody next week. We go to our song.
Yes,
which
it's the Stranglers, Golden Brown.
Jeffrey brought it.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye for now. Bye.